Hi, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This episode is all about the future of cataract surgery. Almost 500,000 cataract operations are carried out every year across the UK. It's one of the most common types of elective surgery undertaken by the NHS, with around 1,500 procedures completed every day. But it's fair to say there are significant challenges facing cataract service delivery. Waiting times are some of the longest in UK healthcare, and they vary massively in different regions. Funding is also tight, with budgets putting restrictions on the number of operations that can be delivered. However, there have been recent advances in how we deliver cataract surgery, innovations even, and that's what I wanted to focus on for this month's podcast. Our listeners have asked us about bilateral surgery, the use of advanced lenses, and interestingly, we'll soon hear from Magdalena Eddington, a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, about dropless cataract surgery.
We started dropless cataract surgery in September 2025. Prior to that, I had some experience of dropless surgery purely on a case-by-case basis, so very specific patients who just could not cope with drop instillation. So it has been a fantastic experience to be able to offer that to all of our patients. And now we've done over 10,000 cases with dropless surgery, so we'll be hoping to publish our results very soon, so keep an eye out for that.
I wanted to understand how all of these surgical innovations are having a positive impact on patient care, as well as, in some cases, improving access to treatment. To begin, I'm with David Lockington. David is a consultant ophthalmologist in Glasgow, and he's also the president of the UK and Ireland Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons. David, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Michelle. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start by setting the scene. What do you think are the current challenges in providing timely access to cataract surgery on the NHS across the UK?
Well, it's hard to speak across the UK, obviously, but I think there's some big principles and some big issues which affect everybody. It's interesting to look on the news and see how patients in England can almost choose the location of their surgery through choosing book, and then see how these things are funded or not funded, or how the funding is switched on and switched off, and the impact of patients. In Scotland, we have these national waiting time centres, one of which is the Golden Jubilee Hospital in Glasgow. And this is why I wanted to touch on what I see as a big issue with only the one diagnosis. Because the danger is we become a two-tier system based on how the patient got into the system. So if I go to my local optometrist and I have a cataract, I can get referred into the local NHS. And then, depending on how there is capacity available, I may be redirected to the Golden Jubilee or the appropriate waiting time centre. There's one in Inverness as well. And I will get my cataract done in a faster time than if I am within the eye service with another pathology and I'm put on the list.
So in Scotland, you have waiting time centres. In England, a rough equivalent would be a high-volume independent cataract service provider.
Yeah, so the treatment centres do a great job getting through standard cases. But the concern is a lot of money has been given to that resource. And we all know that ophthalmology is more than just cataracts.
Of course.
And patients have more than just cataracts wrong with them. And so it feels sometimes that if you've got a cataract, you've the golden ticket. But if you've got other things going on, capacity and resourcing is going to not be as directed towards you. So there is a bit of a tension there.
You know, I work for an independent service provider, and where someone is referred in who already has diagnosed glaucoma, we do contact the managing consultant to confirm whether they're happy for the patient to have a cataract operation or whether they would rather the patient wait to be seen within their glaucoma setting. So we do try and avoid that tension by having that process in place. But as you say, sometimes patients may be waiting a very long time and they'd rather have their cataract removed so they can see in the meantime because there are other issues. And I guess one of the other co-pathologies that comes up really commonly now, particularly because we're detecting it more, is medical retina issues in terms of the macula, you know, ERMs, epithelial membranes. So when is it appropriate to refer for a VR opinion and when is it appropriate to refer for cataract surgery?
That's a fantastic illustration of how the capacity cannot keep up with the demand. So in an ideal world, everybody gets multiple investigations and you measure twice and you cut once. And I would lump macular OCT in there. But the more macular OCTs you do, the more epiretinal membranes or funny looking reflexes you're going to get. And are they visually significant or not? And so then when you speak to your retinal colleagues, it may be the case that they say, oh, that would be worth doing an epiretinal membrane peel at the same time. But in the NHS, that patient is always going to be bumped by the emergency retinal detachment. So they're going to wait longer and longer and longer. I remember speaking to a retinal colleague about some of the posterior polar cataracts, because obviously there could be a breach in the posterior capsule and they may end up with a dropped nucleus and they may require a second procedure. And I asked them, what do you want me to do whenever I come across a posterior polar cataract? And their response was, if you have the skill set and you're competent, then you should get on and do the cataract. And if we end up having to deal with the complication, so be it. Because otherwise, they're just going to wait forever and their cataract is invariably going to be a problem whenever the operation happens. To know that the macula is clear would be very useful, because the most important differentiator in all this is an educated patient is going to be a happy patient. If you have a chat before the operation, that's called consent. If you have a chat after the operation, that may be a complication. So having discussed the likely outcomes with the patient, then they are going to be primed and accepting of what the outcomes are going to be. And so, for example, if the optom does the appropriate measurements and tests, and that's included in the referral letter, then the hospitalized service in whatever format they are, if they're focused on just doing the cataract, then the patient will have hopefully good outcomes.
I was talking to a VR surgeon just on the previous podcast, actually, and he said the key thing is about distortion. If they've got distortion rather than just blur, then it probably is worth referring for a VR opinion, as long as the patient is prepared to wait on the NHS. But if they've got no distortion and only a mild epiretinal membrane, just remove the cataract first and then deal with whatever comes later.
Yeah, so the question is, are we treating the patient or are we treating the investigation? So we may see things on OCT and the patient may be entirely asymptomatic. Now, it depends how dense their cataract is, obviously, and it may be that it's masking macular symptoms, but absolutely. And that would be my kind of yardstick if they're complaining of distortion. But similarly, if you have good referral pathways, some people post-pandemic have switched to these virtual clinics. So if your local facility has the ability to review OCTs, you can ask that question, and then depending on who is vetting and triaging essentially the referrals, then the patient can be directed to the correct person at the correct time. And that is how you make anything efficient. And I'm just going to make a little comment about triage, because with my Northern Ireland accent, it's hard to say this, but triage contains three R's, and they are reassure, react, refer. So this is my job, the same as your job, same as everybody's job. So number one is reassure, nothing needs done. React means I need to do something. Refer means somebody else needs to do something. And then you have the degree of urgency. So in any patient you see, you're asking yourself the three R's. Do I need to reassure, react, or refer? And I think that's an easy way then to know when you see these patients who are just a cataract. I'm a great believer that no one is just a cataract. And I think with that mentality, then people won't go wrong.
That leads you really nicely into the next question, actually, David, because sometimes patients, they've gone through the system, we want to do cataract surgery for them, but their surgery's delayed because they're at an increased risk because they've got another co-pathology or another ocular condition, or they've got a history of a condition. So in the community, optometrists know that history. So what can they do to help to reduce the risk of potential delay? Because obviously it's not in anyone's interest to delay patients unnecessarily. I'm thinking the obvious one to me is patients that have blepharitis or poorly managed MGD, but I'm sure there's others as well, isn't there? So what can we do? What would you like optometrists to do?
So I think it's about optimising what is treatable. So it's not just we want to make this eye perfect. There's a purpose behind it. So as you mentioned, blepharitis. there are only three things which have been proven to reduce the rate of endophthalmitis, which is a blinding infection after cataract surgery. In reverse order, there's intracameral kefiroxime, so an injection of antibiotic at the end of the operation. There's the use of povidone iodine to sterilize the ocular surface before the operation starts. And there's the management of blepharitis. So the reason you're treating the blepharitis is so that that eye is optimized and as clean as possible before the patient comes into the hospital eye system. And if you don't do that, then they're going to have that managed. So you're going to waste an appointment essentially to do that.
But it's not just about infection control, is it?
No, it's also the dry ocular surface. And so we know blepharitis is inflammatory and dry eye is inflammatory. So if you optimize the ocular surface, it's not just to make the patient feel more comfortable. We know the tear film is the first refractive surface, but we also know that how we measure the lens choice through biometry is going to be reliant on things like keratometry, which is going to be more reliable if the ocular surface is healthy. So we want the best measurements, and so then the patients will have the appropriate lenses to then have the best outcome. So it's very easy to treat the lids and lubricate the surface as a precursor for those patients to go in to the hospital. It would be helpful that they weren't wearing their contact lenses. And so generally a rule of thumb would be 1 week for soft and over 2 weeks for hard to allow the corneas to settle down and remove warpage. So knowing that they're out of their lenses means on the day of their clinic appointment, they will get their biometry done rather than having to bring them back with an optimized surface and repeat their biometry. And similarly, if you have documented evidence of their refraction, whether it be changing in terms of myopic shift, or if there is evidence of astigmatism, then knowing the magnitude of that will also then probably prompt further tomography, which may suggest if a patient is appropriate for a toric lens. So there's these sort of nuances. I would hope that optometrists are only ever referring people who have been dilated, because that bigger pupil will show you pseudoexfoliation. It will also show you if there's slight phacodenesis and if this is going to be a more complex operation. And in that young patient, have they actually had trauma which they've forgotten about?
So what kind of trauma might that be?
Things like, have they had intravitreal injections? And have they suddenly had a reduction in their vision and someone has inadvertently touched the back of the lens with their needle? Looking at the back of the eye, as we said, we may not have a view because of the density of the cataract, but knowing if there's macular changes, pressure problems with the disc, other things going on, to just make sure the patient knows that they are either a low risk, a medium risk, or a high risk in terms of the surgery, and then a good prognosis or a guarded prognosis in terms of their potential outcome. And then asking about other comorbidities and medications. As we know, the prostate medications can influence how the iris behaves during surgery. So there's so many things to think about rather than just saying, oh, it's just a simple cataract. And from a surgeon's perspective, it's arrogant to say, this is just a simple cataract. You can only say it's simple when it's being completed safely.
Yes. And the patient's happy and has a great outcome. I suppose really when you refer, what you want to do is make sure you include all the relevant information about medications. And the other thing that you mentioned briefly there was trauma. Again, include the previous ocular history. If there's a history of uveitis, recurrent uveitis, you know, herpes, simplex, for example, all those things are relevant, isn't it?
So Michelle, that's a really great point, which I didn't bring out, because you're providing information, I said originally, to triage. So how do we risk stratify these patients? But the first duty of a doctor is not actually to do good, it's to do no harm. And by extension, optometry IP prescribers have that same role. So the person who's going to do harm to the patient with a prescription pad is us. So you want to have a history to impact and influence what you prescribe. So as you quite rightly said, if someone has had a history of uveitis, then there's a higher chance of post-op inflammation. So we should know that, so we can actually ensure that their post-op management is appropriate. Similarly, if they've had herpetic eye disease and we're going to put them on steroids, there's a chance of reactivating that disease, so we should know about that. If they're a steroid responder, we should know about that, you know, because it's going to influence what you do. And so I think what you said is entirely valid. It's not trying to get someone else to do our job for us. Having more information helps us make educated decisions, particularly in the post-op care.
You would hope that patients would remember the medications, but quite often if they're well managed and their conditions are stable, they forget, don't they? They forget that they've got a problem.
Well, the classic example is Flomax, the prostate medication which causes floppy iris syndrome, and that's a lifelong risk. So if you've taken the tablets, and it's not just for males, females also sometimes take these alpha agonists for other reasons. So even if it's not on that drug list, it may be the case that it's going to cause problems. So it's good to ask about these sorts of medications. But you'll know yourself, you have patients who come in and you ask them, have you any medical conditions? And they say no. And then you say, have you your list of tablets? And it's enormous.
Yes. Like,
well, there's obviously a disconnect there between why you think you're taking all these treatments. So that's why asking about Tamsulosin blood pressure tablets. And they're all linked. But the point is, if you know about it, then we would take precautionary measures. So we would use intracameral phenylephrine from the start, and that very much inhibits the behavior of the iris to misbehave. And similarly, if you know their refraction, it's not exact science, but if they're very myopic or very hypermetropic, you know that's going to be a big eye or a small eye, and it might influence what you do. You would have those numbers through your biometry in terms of axial lengths, but it may mean that for the very small eye, they may be better done by different consultants. We may be using topical atropine to try to prevent aqueous misdirection. Or in the very large eyes, we may be trying to do different manoeuvres so the patient's not having discomfort.
So, I mean, thinking about a patient in an optometry practice, at what point do we think actually we should be considering sending this patient for private surgery rather than NHS surgery?
There's two big differences. You're paying to have your operation earlier, and you're also paying to have options of lenses. So, for example, the classic is a patient who's myopic and have these big thick glasses, and you do their surgery on the NHS and you give them outstanding distance vision. And in one hand, they're absolutely delighted that they can see in the distance, which they've never been able to see before, but you've robbed them of their near vision. And I think the historic story about everybody wants to be a fighter pilot, I don't know very many fighter pilots, but I know an awful lot of people who use computers, and I think the world now is intermediate. So explaining to people that that is generally the target which people work at is useful. Now, a lot of people are very happy in their glasses. They feel naked without their glasses, and that's not a problem. But for those people who want to take the opportunity to not require glasses, then I think then they should be looking at other lens options.
And private surgery options can also include bilateral same-day surgery, which appeals to many patients from a convenience point of view.
Yeah, and people would perpetrate the bilateral immediate surgery as a way to speed up neuroadaption if you were using multifocal or trifocal lenses, and I can understand that. Before we were encouraged to do bilateral surgery, if I had patients who I thought would end up having big anisometropia, I would try to book them 1 week apart or 2 weeks apart, but again, that's not always easy in the NHS, obviously much easier to do in the private sector. And so increasingly, from an efficiency point of view and from a green issues point of view, we are now offering immediate bilateral cataract surgery at the same day, as long as it is within the guidelines to ensure that one eye is treated entirely differently from the other eye. So the risk of a bilateral endophthalmitis is vanishingly rare, as long as your infection control policies are in place.
And this leads us very nicely into sort of innovations, because you've talked about how times are changing. We're thinking more along the lines of bilateral surgery now, but there are other innovations in cataract surgery and how we deliver cataract surgery. So I wanted to ask you about dropless surgery. What does that actually mean? Because that's very much out there in our psyche now, isn't it? Where we're aware of it, but do we really understand it in the community? I'm not sure that we do.
So if you go back in time, patients were given antibiotic drops for a month and steroid drops for a month. And at the time of surgery, they also had a subconjunctival injection of antibiotic and steroids. And the antibiotic was supposed to stop infections, and the steroid was supposed to suppress inflammation, and then by extension, reduce the inflammation which could lead to cystoid macular edema. So it's iritis and CMO. Whenever the intracameral antibiotics came along, then we didn't do the subconj injection anymore. So not only did we not inject the antibiotic around the eye because it was being injected into the eye, but we also forgot that we used to inject steroids around the eye at the time of surgery, and so people were put on the drops afterwards. The research then showed that we really don't need to be doing topical antibiotics for the month after surgery. You're really treating yourself, not the patient. But you still continued with the steroid. The question was then, if we've already put the antibiotic in the eye, could we put the steroid in the eye somehow so patients don't have to use drops afterwards? There's not compliance issues. In Belgium, the government pays for district nurses to come in and put in your drops. So that'd be an enormous saving if that could be taken away. But could we do that either in the irrigation fluid as part of the operation or as a bolus injection at the end? The whole point of this is improving patient compliance by taking the drops out of the equation, and then that improves their convenience. And again, that will help the patients have a better experience. So if we are doing everything we need to do at the time of surgery, then hopefully that will minimize the required follow-up. Though obviously those patients would need a post-op pressure check in case they have a raised pressure. And in extreme circumstances where this has been done for other reasons, sometimes people have had to have the steroid almost cut out of the conjunctiva. So it's not without its risks, but I think in the standard patient with straightforward surgery, I think it will move to being more the standard of care.
And so where a patient does have a steroid response, so let's say the patient's had dropless surgery, they present in the community for their post-op at 4 weeks, and they've got pressures of, say, let's make it a bit more risky, let's say it's 35.
That's not risky. I was thinking 60.
Okay. In the community, 35 and they're worried. So what if a patient was referred back to the hospital? Normally, they would just go on a antihypertensive topical medication. But what you've mentioned there is quite drastic. At what point would you consider that?
This is why we need protocols. So if we are delegating care to the community, then we need to do it with safety netting. So in such a patient, if the pressure is this, then you need to put them on that and you need to treat them with this. And this is the phone line you ring to get them back in. And they may end up also getting acetazolamide alongside topical. And we're going to have to monitor them. And if it's a patient who runs a high pressure for a long time, that area of steroid may ultimately need evacuated before it breaks down. But that hopefully will be a rare situation.
David, thank you. I'll come back to you in just a moment. But I just wanted to dwell on this for a second, because dropless surgery is quite an exciting innovation in this field. So to find out more, I wanted to hear from one of the people at the forefront of this procedure's rollout at an independent service provider, Optegra. Let's hear from Magdalena Eddington.
So I'm Magdalena Eddington, high volume cataract surgeon currently working at Optegra in the Midlands. I've been with Optegra for 2.5 years. Last year I was lead consultant for the Midlands, and recently I have started a new role as training lead. And before I had moved down to England, I was up in Scotland working at the Golden Jubilee, which is a waiting time centre using high volume surgery to tackle the waiting lists in Scotland.
So from your perspective, what are the advantages of dropless surgery?
Well, I'd say the first thing is convenience. So obviously cataract surgery, for the most part, affects a population that is slightly older, so they often have lots of systemic comorbidities as well as ocular comorbidities. We're looking at patients with dementia, with memory problems, tremors, often joint issues, which can make post-operative drop regimes very tricky for patients to adhere to. So not having to deal with all of that is a huge benefit to patients. Other advantages include not having to deal with side effects of drops. So we do have quite a few patients who are allergic to preservatives or who have strong reactions to drugs such as Acular, so the NSAIDs, and they can sting on instillation. So patients really don't enjoy having to use the drops. But I think compliance is so much better, because just remembering the drops, but also actually making sure the drops get into their eyes. So we have patients showing up a week after surgery going, oh, I've been trying to use my drops, they're just pouring down my face and I've already run out. So also having to come back for appointments for repeat prescriptions. So I'd say convenience is probably the biggest factor for patients.
So dropless surgery is an exciting advance, but not everyone is suitable for dropless surgery, are they?
No, of course. I think everything we do, we have to make sure that we assess our patients appropriately, we counsel our patients appropriately, and, you know, it's not a one size-fits-all situation. And I think that has been a lot of concern from the communities. You know, you're just giving steroids to patients and they might have side effects. Well, actually, no, you know, our teams are excellent at assessing patients. And there are certain conditions. So, for example, patients who have either diagnosed or suspected glaucoma, ocular hypertension, or patients who have had previous steroid response, I mean, they shouldn't be receiving a depot steroid because they're at higher risk of having a pressure spike. So those patients would remain on the standard pathway with drops. But if there are no additional risk factors, then we've had fantastic results. And actually, the risk of a pressure spike in our data set has been extremely low.
So patients who are having dropless surgery with Optegra, they're frequently now having their four-week follow-up in the community. So what do optometrists need to be aware of if they're actually looking at a patient that has had dropless surgery?
So I think a pressure check is very important. I think commonly there are concerns because they will still see a bit of chemosis or a white deposit under the conjunctiva, which is the triamcin alone. And that's normal. So there's no need to panic to send the patient back to the hospital. And it can take, you know, a good 6 to 8 weeks to disappear. Also, we do have quite a lot of patients on blood thinners. So they are at higher risk of subconjunctival hemorrhage. So we have been seeing, you know, a lot of concern going, oh my gosh, this patient's had a bleed. That's okay. You know, it's not going to affect their visual outcome. You know, if it happens, I always tell the patient about it and reassure them and say, you know, it will resolve spontaneously over the next couple of weeks. So, you know, by the 4 week check, it should definitely have disappeared, but sometimes patients will rub their eye. And so that I would say, again, don't worry. And that is to be expected if a patient is on blood thinners.
You mentioned the white deposit. So where on the conjunctiva, where on the eye do you actually place the injection?
So we inject inferiorly. We always try and get the patient to look up and try to inject a good 6 millimetres from the limbus inferiorly. However, not all patients can look up or they're struggling. And sometimes that deposit is a bit closer to the limbus and can be visible without actually retracting the lid and looking for it. But again, usually it's well hidden under the lid, doesn't affect the patient's appearance and will disappear with time.
And can it be anywhere inferiorly?
Can be anywhere inferiorly. I just try and get it nice and deep so it's hidden under the lid. But again, it's a decent volume. It's 0.4 mils. So it does track sometimes depending on which layer you get into. So it can, you can get quite a bit of chemosis after surgery as well.
And you have mentioned the potential for a steroid response. So if someone is having a moderate steroid response, let's say, so not enough to perhaps send someone back to the hospital for urgently, but perhaps if their pressures have gone up by 5 or 6 millimetres of mercury, when do you think it's appropriate for the optometrist to bring the patient back again to make sure that their pressures have come down having had dropless surgery? So they've been seen at 4 weeks. So how long does it take for the steroid to leave the eye?
Let's say at least 6 to 8 weeks. So if there is a concern, they could cover the patient with an anti-glaucoma drop in the post-operative period. If it's a minor, you know, a couple of millimetres of mercury and everything else is nice and quiet, they could just monitor and see the patient back in between 2 and 4 weeks.
Okay, that's great. Magdalena, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
For the final word, I'm back with David Lockington. So David, just to finish off, what do you think are the key things for optometrists to look out for when they're dealing with cataract patients, either preoperatively or postoperatively when they come back into the community?
So I'll come back to what I said about triage. It's all risk stratification. So when you see a patient before you refer them in, if that was your relative, what information would you like the ophthalmologist to know so that they get the best care during their surgery? And then postoperatively, what are the things we are concerned about which should be red flags so we can get people back in safely if they have issues? We're so blessed that cataract surgery 99% of the time is life improving and it's fantastic, but we need to not become blasé about an operation which has been devalued because people think it's quick and easy. I would say it's efficient and safe, and that means that it is quicker than other operations. But I always tell my trainees when they say, how fast can you do an operation? I always say I can blind someone in seconds. So we need to just be sensible and aware. So there's no such thing as a straightforward cataract. There's no such thing as a simple post-op. What we do is we take the proper history, we do a relevant examination, we do the necessary investigations, and then we can decide, are we going to reassure, react, or refer? And I think if you stick with those guidelines and remember, if this was my relative, how would I like them to be treated? I think we won't go far wrong.
That's great, David. Thank you very much.
Michelle, thanks so much for having me. It's always a privilege chatting.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Also, if you've got a topic in mind that you'd like us to cover, you can email us on podcast@docket.info or use LinkedIn to send us a message. There's a link in the podcast description. By completing the short exercise on our website for this episode, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice and professionalism. We'll be back again next month, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. But that's all from us now. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.